Mr. Friedman's address will be continued on the second recording, along with a question and answer period between Mr. Friedman and the audience.
Now, the king became so disgusted with the degeneracy of his kingdom that he decided to adopt a so-called monotheistic faith, either Christianity, Islam, the Muslim faith, or what is known today as Judaism, really Talmudism. So, like spinning a top, he said, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, and he picked out so-called Judaism. And that became the state religion, and he sent down to the Talmudic schools of Tel Aviv and Sura, and brought up thousands of these rabbis with their teachings, and he opened up synagogues and schools in his kingdom of 800,000 people, 800,000 square miles, and maybe 10 to 20 million people, and they became what we call Jews. There wasn't one of them that ever had an ancestor that ever put a toe in the Holy Land, not alone in Old Testament history, but back to time, the beginning of time. Not one of them. And yet they come to the Christians and they ask us to support their armed insurrection in Palestine by saying, well, you want to certainly help repatriate God's chosen people to their promised land, their ancestral homeland. It's your Christian duty. We gave you one of our boys as your Lord and Savior. You now go to church on Sunday and kneel, and you worship a Jew, and we are Jews. Well, they were pagan Khazars who were converted just the same as the Irish. And it's just as ridiculous to call them people of the Holy Land as it would be. There are 54 million Chinese Muslims. 54 million. And Muhammad only died in 620 AD. So in that time, 54 million Chinese have accepted Islam as their religious belief. Now imagine in China, 2,000 miles away from Arabia, where the city of Mecca is located, where Muhammad was born. Imagine if the 54 million Chinese called themselves Arabs. Imagine. Why, you'd say they're lunatics. Any man that believes that those 54 million Chinese are Arabs must be crazy. All they did was adopt as a religious faith a belief that had its origin in Mecca, in Arabia. The same as the Irish. When the Irish became Christians, nobody dumped them in the ocean and imported from the Holy Land a new crop of inhabitants that were Christians, that had Christian flesh and blood. They weren't different people. They were the same people, but they had accepted Christianity as their religious faith. Now these pagans, these Asiatics, these Turco-Finns, they were a Mongoloid race who were forced out of Asia into Eastern Europe. They likewise, because their king took the faith, this Talmudic faith, they had no choice, just the same as in Spain. If the king was Catholic, everybody had to be a Catholic. If not, you had to get out of Spain. So everybody, they lived on the land, just like the trees and the bushes. A human being belonged to the land under that feudal system. So they all became what we call today Jews. Now imagine how silly it was for the Christians, for the great Christian countries of the world to say, we're going to use our power, our prestige, to help repatriate God's chosen people to their ancestral homeland, their promised land. Now, could there be a bigger lie than that? Could there be a bigger lie than that? And because they control the newspapers, the magazines, the radio, the television, the book publishing business, they have the ministers in the pulpit, they have the politicians on the soapboxes talking the same language, so naturally, you believe black is white if you heard it often enough. You wouldn't call black black anymore. You'd start to call black white, and nobody could blame you. Now, that is one of the great lies. That is the foundation of all the misery that has befallen the world. Because after two wars fought in Europe, World War I and World War II, if it wasn't possible for them to live in peace and harmony with the people in Europe, like their brethren are living in the United States, what were the two wars fought for? Did they have to, like you, flush the toilet because they couldn't get along? Did they have to say, well, we're going back to our homeland and you Christians help us? I can't understand yet how the Christians in Europe could have been that dumb, because every theologian, every history teacher knew the things that I'm telling you. But they naturally bribed them, shut them up with money, stuffed their mouth with money. And now, I don't care whether you know all this or not. It doesn't make any difference to me whether you know all these facts or not. But it does make a big difference to me. I've got, in my family, boys that will have to be in the next war. And I don't want them to go and fight and die like they died in Korea, like they died in Japan, like they died all over the world. For what? To help crooks hold on to what they stole from innocent people who had been in peaceful possession of that land, those farms, those homes, for hundreds and maybe thousands of years? Is that why the United States must go to war? Because the Democratic Party wants New York State, the electoral vote, Illinois, the electoral vote, in Pennsylvania, the electoral votes, which are controlled by the Zionists and their co-religionists, the balance of power. In New York City, there are 400,000 members of the Liberal Party, all Zionists and their co-religionists. And New York State went for Kennedy by 400,000 votes. Now, I don't blame Mr. Kennedy. I'm fond of Mr. Kennedy. I think he's a great man. I think he can really pull us out of this trouble if we get the facts to him. And I believe he knows a great deal more than his appointments indicate he knows. He's playing with the enemy. Like when you go fishing, you've got to play with the fish. Let him out and pull him in, and let him out and pull him in. But knowing Mr. Kennedy's father and how well informed he is on this whole subject and how close Kennedy is to his father, I don't think Mr. Kennedy is totally in the dark. But I do think that it is the duty of every mother, every loyal Christian, every person that regard the defense of this country as a sacred right, that they communicate not with their congressman, not with their senator, but with President Kennedy and tell him, I do not think that you should send my boy or our boys wearing the uniform of the United States of America and under the flag that you see here, our red, white, and blue, to fight there to help keep in the hands of thieves that which they have stolen. I think everyone should not alone write once, but keep writing and get your friends to write. Now, I could go on endlessly and tell you these things to support what I have just asked you to do, but I don't think it's necessary to do that. You're above the average group in intelligence, and I don't think it's necessary to impress this anymore. But I want to tell you one more thing. You talk about, oh, the Jews. Why the Jews? Christianity. Why we got Christianity from the Jews. And the Jews gave us Jesus, and the Jews gave us our religion. But do you know that on the Day of Atonement that you think is so sacred to them, that on that day, and I was one of them. This is not hearsay. I'm not here to be a rabble-rouser. I'm here to give you facts. When on the Day of Atonement you walk into a synagogue, the very first prayer that you recite, you stand, and it's the only prayer for which you stand, and you repeat three times a short prayer, the Kal Nidre. you enter into an agreement with God Almighty that any oath, vow, or pledge that you may make during the next 12 months, any oath, vow, or pledge that you may take during the next 12 months shall be null and void. The oath shall not be an oath, the vow shall not be a vow, the pledge shall not be a pledge, they shall have no force and effect, and so forth and so on. And further than that, the Talmud teaches, don't forget, whenever you take an oath, vow, and pledge, remember the Kol Nidre prayer that you recited on the Day of Atonement, and that exempts you from fulfilling that. How much can you depend upon their loyalty? You can depend upon their loyalty as much as the Germans depended upon it in 1916. And we're going to suffer the same fate that Germany suffered, and for the same reason. You can't depend upon something as insecure as the leadership that is not obliged to respect an oath, vow, or pledge. Now, I could go on and recite many other things to you, but I would have a little respect for your time, and you want to get through with all this. Tomorrow is going to be a long day. Now, I want to say one thing. You ask me, well, you think to yourself, well, how did this fellow get mixed up in this the way he got mixed up in it? Well, I opened my mouth in 1945. And I took big pages in newspapers and tried to tell the American people what I'm telling you. And one newspaper after another refused the advertisement. And when I couldn't find a newspaper to take them, I paid cash, not credit. What happened? My lawyer told me, well, there's an editor over in Jersey with a paper. He'll take your announcement. So I was brought together with Mr. McGinley, and that's how I met him. So somebody told me, the lawyer who introduced me, who was the son of the dean of the Methodist bishop, he said, well, I think he's a little anti-Semitic. I don't know whether I can get him over here. So he brought him over to my apartment, and we hit it off wonderfully and have since then. Now, I say this, and I say it without any qualification, I say it without any reservation, and I say it without any hesitation. If it wasn't for the work that Mr. Conde McGinley did with common sense, he's been sending out from 1,800,000 to 2 million every year. If it wasn't the work that he'd been doing, sending those out for 15 years now, we would already be a communist country. Nobody has done what he did to light fires. Many of the other active persons in this fight learned all about it for the first time through common sense. Now, I have been very active in helping him all I could. I'm not as flush as I was. I cannot go on spending the money. I'm not going to take up a collection, don't worry. I see five people getting up to leave. I haven't got the money that I used to spend. I used to print 250,000 of them out of my own pocket and send them out. Mr. McGinley, when I first met him, had maybe 5,000 printed and circulated them locally. So I said, with what you know and what I know, we can really do a good job. So I started printing in outside shops and big newspaper companies 250,000 and paid for them. Well, there's always a bottom to the barrel. I suppose we've all reached that time. Well, I'm not so poor that I can't live without working, and that's what worries the Anti-Defamation League. I can just get by without going and asking for a job or getting on the breadline. But Mr. McGinley is working, he's sick in bed, and he's going at this stronger than ever. And all I want to say is that they want to close up common sense more than any other single thing in the whole world as a death blow to the fight Christians are making to survive. So I want to just tell you this. All they do is circulate rumors. Mr. Benjamin H. Friedman, the wealthy backer of common sense. Well, The reason they do that is to discourage the people in the United States. Don't send any money to Common Sense. They don't need it. They've got the wealthy Mr. Friedman as a backer. That all has strategy. They don't want to advertise me so that people that have real estate or securities to sell will come and call on me. They just want people to lay off Common Sense. And all I'm telling you is, I do try to help them, but I haven't been able to, and I'll be very honest. One thing I won't do is lie. In the last year, I've had so much sickness in my family that I could not give him $1. How he managed to survive, I don't know. God alone knows, and he must be in God's care, because how he pulled through with his sickness and with his financial troubles, I don't know, but that press is working, and every 2 weeks, about 100, 150,000 of Common Sense go out with a new message. And if that information could be multiplied, if people that now get it could buy 10 or 25 or 50, give them around, plow that field, sow those seeds. You don't know which will take root, but for God's sake, this is our last chance, and I know there are many other people in the field that are doing wonderful work. Mr. Goff, Mrs. Elizabeth Dilling, there are many, but none of them can say that they send out close to 2 million for 15 years, and at $1 a year. I've had almost fist fights with Mr. McGinley. Why don't you raise that to $3? How can he send out 24 at $1, and then when he gets a new subscriber, he'll give them $2 or $3 worth of circulars? And I would say that if there's one man that we want to keep into this fight, it's Conley McGinley. And rather than buy lipstick or cigarettes or whiskey, rather than bet on racehorses, go out and pay, I don't know what you call it, to play golf. You pay something to hit the ball, a tee fee or something. A green fee, thanks. I never played golf yet. I got a ball, so why chase after one? So anyhow, I'm telling you, if you want to make a sacrifice, if you want to make last year's slip due again, if you want to alter a dress to make it due again this year, if men, instead of going out and seeing a new necktie, you forego that necktie, keep poor Mr. McGinley, number one, alive. He's on his, maybe his deathbed. Nobody knows. He's very, very sick. Very sick. And number two, keep him in this fight. There is somebody here identified with that operation, so I wouldn't dare tell an untruth. I respect that person's confidence in me, but every day they owe more and more money to their creditors, and the time is going to come when they will be shut down, because there is no such animal as a wealthy Mr. Friedman to pick up the checks for them. That day is gone. I have my own responsibilities, and I'm glad to make both ends meet, and thank God for that. I will say that since 1933, I have spent of my lifetime's accumulations and hard work, according to the Department of Justice, who investigated me to convince themselves I wasn't an Arab propagandist receiving money from the Grand Mufti, I have spent $2,400,000+ that I accumulated through hard work. And I think it's time that a few of the other people picked up the check. And I will say, I found it very hard and very sad to do, because people said, why that Jew, why those Jew bastards, they're always the same, or goddamn Jew, you can't trust them, or what is he coming around here for, to go and report me to the Anti-Defamation League? And I had a tough time, so I said, fine all, I'm just working with Mr. McGinley. And I will admit that people who are in a position to assess my integrity, like Mr. Alan Dole here, and others have all come around and said, some of them, in so many words, well, you have sure been a damn fool. I really threw myself into this fight, and I'm going to do it as long as the breath of life is left in me, and all I'm asking you all to do is buy one less pack of cigarettes a week, you ladies buy one less lipstick a month, and keep common sense afloat. Because if it sinks, Christianity will sink with it. And mark my words, I hope it will never come to pass. But if you don't, you will see it come to pass. Now, is there anyone who would like to ask me a question? I'd like you to ask anything that's on your conscience, no matter what it is. All right, I'll comment on that. Now, I don't want to get into this question. It's rather deep, but you all have a very high degree of intelligence, so I'm going to make an attempt. In the time of Bible history, there was a geographic area known as Judea. Judea was a province of the Roman Empire. Now, a person who lived in Judea was known as a Judean, and in Latin, it was Judaeus, and in Greek, it was Judaeus. Those are the two words, Greek and Latin, for a Judean. Now, the word in Latin and Greek, there is no such letter as J, and the first syllable of Judaeus and Judaeus starts Jew. Now, when the Bible was written, it was first written in Greek, Latin, Canaanitic, Syriac, Aramaic, all those languages. Never was the word Jew in any of them, because the word didn't exist. Judea was the country, and the people were Judeans, and Jesus was referred to only as a Judean. I have seen those earliest scripts available. I'm always at the American Bible Society, and there was no such thing. In 1345, a man by the name of Wycliffe in England thought it was time to translate the Bible into English. There was no English edition of the Bible, because who the devil could read? It was only the educated church people who could read Latin and Greek, Syriac, Aramaic, and the other languages. Anyhow, Wycliffe thought, I'm going to make this translation into English. And he did. But in it, he had to look around for some words for Judaeus and Judaeus. There was no English word because Judea had passed out of existence. There was no Judea. People had long ago forgotten that. So he, in the first translation, used the word in referring to Jesus as G-Y-U, Jew. The first translation of the Bible, of the scriptures into English, Jesus was referred to as G-Y-U, Jew. There was no printing press. Now, between 1345 and the 17th century, when the printing press came into use, that word passed through so many changes. I have them all here. If you want, I can read them to you. I will. That word, Jew, which was in the Wycliffe Bible, became it was first G-Y-U, Jew, then G-I-U, Jew, then I-U, Jew, because the I in Latin is pronounced like the J, like J Julius Caesar is I-U-L. There is no J in Latin. Then I-U-W, Jew. Then I-E-U-U. Then I-E-U-I, Jewy. Then I-W-E. Then I-O-W. Then I-E-W-E, all in Bible. As time went on. Then I-E-U-E. Then I-U-E. Then I-V-E. Then I-E-W. And finally, in the 18th century, J-E-W, Jew. All the corrupt and contracted forms for Judaeus and Judaeus in Latin. Now, there was no such thing as Jew. And any theologian, I've lectured in maybe 20 of the most prominent theological seminaries in this country, and two in Europe, there was no such word as Jew. There only was Judea. And Jesus was a Judean. And the first English use of a word in an English Bible to describe him was G-Y-U, Jew, a contracted and shortened form of Judaeus. Just the same as we call a lab for laboratory, and we call a pram for a perambulator, and gas for gasoline. There's a tendency to shorten up. So who in England knew if you put out in spelling Judaeus or Judaeus, the English, there were no public schools, people didn't know how to read it, they wouldn't know what it was. It looked like a scrambled alphabet. So they made a short word out of it. Like in England, they call a public house, which is a bar in our country, a pub. Easy to remember and simple. Now, for a theologian to say that you can't harm the Jews is just ridiculous, because I'd like to know where in the scriptures it says that. I'd like to know the text. But now they say in Germany, look at what happened to Germany for touching the Jews. What would you, as a citizen of the United States, do to people that did to you what the so-called Jews, the Polacks and Litvaks and Galicianers, they weren't Jews, as I just explained to you. They were Eastern Europeans who'd been converted to Talmudism. There was such a thing as Judaism. Judaism was a name given in recent years to this religion known in Bible history as Torah Piyava. No Jew or no educated person ever heard of Judaism. It didn't exist. They pulled it out of the air, a meaningless word, just like anti-Semitic. The Arabs are the Semites, and the Christians go around talking about people who don't like Jews as anti-Semites, and they call all the Arabs anti-Semites. The only Semites in the world are the Jews, are the Arabs. There isn't one Jew who's a Semite. They're all Turco-Finn Mongoloids, the Eastern European Jews. So they brainwash the public. And if you will invite me to meet this reverend who told you these things, I'll convince him, and it'll be one step in the right direction, and I'll go wherever I have to go to meet him. Yes, ma'am. Well, I can answer that. First of all, your first premise is wrong. Your first premise is wrong, that all the Jews are loyal to each other, because the Eastern European Jews outnumber all the rest by so many that they create the impression that they are the Jewish race, that they are the Jewish nation, that they are the Jewish people, and the Christians swallow it like a cream puff. But in 1844, the German rabbis called a conference of rabbis from all over the world for the purpose of abolishing the Kal Nidre from the Day of Atonement religious ceremony. And they called in all these rabbis. And in Brunswick, Germany, where that was held in 1844, there was almost a terrific riot, a civil war, while the Eastern Europeans said, what the hell, we should give up Kal Nidre? That gives us our grip on our people. We give them a franchise so that they can tell the Christians, go to hell, we'll make any deal you want, but They don't have to carry it out. That gives us our grip on our people. So they're not so united. And if you knew the feeling that exists, now I'll also show you from an official document by the man responsible, for, we baptized this way, that here is a paper that we obtained from the archives of the Zionist organization in New York City, and in it is the manuscript by Sir James A. Malcolm, who, on behalf of the British cabinet, negotiated the deal with the Zionists. And in here he says that all the Jews in England were against it. The Jews that had been there for years, the Sephardic, those that had Portuguese and Spanish and Dutch ancestors, who were monotheists and believed in that religious belief, while these Eastern European Jews were still running around in the heart of Asia. And then they came into Europe. But they had no more to do with them than, can you talk about a Christian race or a Christian religion? Or are the Christians united? Well, the same disunity exists amongst the Jews. And I'll show you in this same document that when they went to France to try and get the French government to back that Zionist adventure, there was only one Jew in France who was for it. That was Rothschild. And they did it because they were interested in the oil and the Suez Canal. You know why? You know why? Because if they don't, they're dead ducks. They come around and they tell you how much you must give. And if you don't, oh, you're anti-Semitic. Then none of their friends will have anything to do with them. And they start a smear campaign, and you've got to give. In New York City, in the Garment Center, there are 12 manufacturers in the building, and when the drive is on to sell Israel bombs, the United Jewish drive, they put a big scoreboard with the names of the firms, and opposite them, as you make the amount they put you down for, they put a gold star. And the buyers are told, when you come into that building to call on someone, and they haven't got a gold star, go up and tell them you won't buy from them until they have a gold star. Blackmail. I don't know what else you can call it. Then what do they do? They tell you it's for humanitarian purposes, and they've sent maybe $8 billion to Israel, tax exempt, tax deductible. So if they hadn't sent that $8 billion to Israel, $7 billion of it would have gone into the United States Treasury as income tax. So what happens? That $7 billion deficit, that air pocket, the dumb Christians have to make up. They put a bigger tax on gas or bread or corporation tax. Somebody has to pay the housekeeping expenses for the government. So why do you let these people spend their money over there to buy guns, to drive people out of their ancient homeland, and you say, oh, well, the poor Jews, they have no place to go, and they're persecuted all their life. They've never been persecuted for religion. And I wish I had two rows of rabbis here to challenge me. Never once in all history have they been persecuted for their religion. Do you know why the Jews were driven out of England? You know, they were. In Edward I in 1285, and they never came back until the Cromwell Revolution, which was financed by the Rothschilds. For 400 years, there wasn't a Jew. But do you know why they were driven out of? Because in the Christian faith and the Muslim faith, it's a sin to charge rent for the use of money. In other words, what we call interest is a sin. So the Jews had a monopoly in England, and they charged so much interest. And when the lords and dukes couldn't pay, they foreclosed. And they were creating so much trouble that the King of England finally made himself their partner, because when they came to foreclose, some of these dukes bumped off the Jews, the moneylenders. So the king finally said, and this is all in history, look up Hyamson or Raw, The History of the Jews in England, two books you can find in your library, that when The king found out what this trouble was all about, and he found out how much money they were making. He declared himself a 50% partner of the moneylenders, Edward I. And for many years, one-third of the revenue of the British Treasury came from the 50% interest in moneylending by the Jews. But it got worse and worse, so much worse, that they kept up this idea of bumping off the moneylenders. And then the King of England said, well, I declare myself the heir of all the moneylenders. If they're bumped off, you've got to pay me. I'm his sole heir. So that made so much trouble because the king had to go out and collect it with an army that he told the Jews, get the hell out of here. And he gave every Jew, there were 15,000 of them, they had to get out, and they went across to Ireland. And that's how Ireland got into the United Kingdom. When King Edward found out what they were doing, he said, well, if anybody takes that nice island over there, I'm going to take it for myself. And he sent Robert Southguard with a mercenary army and conquered Ireland. So show me one time. There is no case in all history that I know about where a Jew was persecuted in any country because he went home and put on those things, the talus and trillum, and said, Shema Yisrael, instead of going into a church and saying, Our Father in Heaven. Not one. It's always their impact on the political, social, or economic customs and traditions of the community in which they settle. Now, somebody back there wants to answer. Yes, sir.
I have my hand ready.
Well, they say most of those things themselves. It was unnecessary for Benjamin Franklin to say it. Most of those things they say themselves. But now let me tell you, Benjamin Franklin observed and by hearsay understood what was happening in Europe. When Russia in 920 was formed and gradually surrounded the Khazar kingdom and then absorbed them, most of the well-to-do Khazars fled to Western Europe and brought with them the very things to which you object and I object and a lot of other people object. The customs, the habits, the instincts with which they were endowed. Now, Benjamin Franklin refers to them as Jews because that's the name that they went by. That's the name that they took. And the Christians, when they first heard that these people that were fleeing from Russia, who they were, that they had practiced this Talmudic faith, the Christians in Western Europe said, they must be the remnants of the lost 10 tribes. And Mr. Gress, the greatest historian amongst the Jews, says that. And he's probably as good an authority on that subject as there is. So that when Benjamin Franklin came to Europe, in let's say the 18th century, he already saw the result of what these people had done after they left their homeland. And every word of it is gospel. Every word of it. And they themselves say it. I can give you a half a dozen books that they've written in which they say that. That when they have money, they become tyrants, and when they become defeated, they become ruthless. They state it. They're only barbarians. They're the descendants of Asiatic Mongols, and they will do anything to accomplish their purpose. What right did they have to do? What right did they have to take over Russia the way they did? The Tsar had abdicated 10 months before that, or 9 months before that. There was no need for them. They were going to have a constitutional monarchy, but they didn't want that. And so when the constitutional monarchy was to assemble in November, they mowed them all down and established the Soviet Union. There was no need for that, but they thought, now is the time. And if you will look in the Encyclopedia Britannica under the word Bolshevism, you will find the five laws there that Lenin puts down for a successful revolution. And one of them is, wait for the right time, and then give them everything you've got. It would pay you to read that. You'd also find that Mr. Harold Lasky, who wrote the article for the Encyclopedia Britannica, states that the Jews conceived and created and cultivated the communist movement, and that their energy made them the spearhead of the movement. Harold Lasky wrote it, and no one knew more about communism than he, and the Encyclopedia Britannica for 25 years has been printing it. What more do you want? Anybody else? Well, I can't advocate that you do anything that's criminal or that might get your boys into trouble, but I can tell you this, that you can start what I call an endless chain if you can get your friends to write objecting to it. Here is the statement. Mr. Kennedy's office gave me this himself. Mr. Smith, who succeeded Mr. Kennedy, took over his office, was in his office and gave me this. For release to AM, that means morning papers, August 26th. He delivered this on the 25th. And it says here, Israel is here to stay. That Israel is here to stay. It is a national commitment. Special obligation on the Democratic Party. The White House must take the lead. American intervention. We will act promptly and decisively against any nation in the Middle East which attacks its neighbor. I propose that we make clear to both Israel and the Arab states our guarantee that we will act with whatever force and speed are necessary to halt any aggression by any nation. Well, do you call the return of people to their homeland aggression? Is Mr. Kennedy going to do that? Suppose 3 million Mexicans came into Texas and drove the 6 million Texans into the deserts of Arizona and New Mexico. Suppose these Mexicans were slipped in there, armed, the Texans are disarmed, and one night they drove them all out of Texas and they declared themselves the Republic of the Alamo. What would the United States say? Would we say it's aggression for these Texans to try to get their homes back from these Mexican thieves? Suppose the Negroes in Alabama were secretly armed by the Soviets, and overnight they rose up and drove all the whites into the swamps of Mississippi and Georgia and Florida. Drove them out completely, and they declared themselves the Republic of Ham or the Republic of something or other. Would we call it aggression if these people, the whites of Alabama, tried to go back to their homes? What would we think if the Soviet Union says, no, those Negroes now occupy them, let them there? Or if the Soviet Union said, no, those Mexicans are in Texas, they declared themselves a sovereign state, leave them there. You have plenty of room in Utah and Nevada. Settle them elsewhere. Would we call it aggression if the Alabama whites or the Texans wanted to go back to their homes? So now you've got to write to President Kennedy and say, we do not consider it aggression in the sense that you use the word if these people want to return to their homes as United Nations 15 times in the last 12 years called upon the Zionists in occupation of Palestine to allow these people to return to their former homes and farms. Now, I'm sure that Kennedy is smart, and when he used the word aggression, he may have had in the back of his mind, well, maybe I can get out of this. You can't call it aggression if people merely want to get back to their homes.
You have just heard an address by Benjamin H. Friedman, World Authority, on the communist conspiracy and its treasonous aims to unleash the United States into a third world war. Mr. Friedman's talk has been recorded on 2 12-inch long playing records, which can be played on any home phonograph. You can purchase these 2 recordings for a total of $6. Order them from Christian Education Association, Union, New Jersey. The publishers of Common Sense, America's newspaper against communism, reaching more people than any anti-communist newspaper in the world. The subscription price to Common Sense is only a dollar a year. Every real American home should have both of these long-playing records to play for friends who visit, before church groups, patriotic and veterans organizations, and civic and women's clubs. The address for your two recordings is on the label of the record you just heard, but we repeat it now for your convenience to get your copies of this, The Third World War. Mail your check or money order to Christian Education Association, Union, New Jersey. $6 for both records, $1 for a year's subscription to Common Sense. Get them both. Thank you.